It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! Oh!
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me.
Don't speak, bitch. Come on now.
You have legs.
They've made Solo a monster.
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want.
Welcome to episode 881 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off. It is Sunday, September 29th, 2024. I am the Solo Monster. First and foremost, I hope everybody is safe after Hurricane Helene this week. Very scary storm. I know some of you are down in the southeast and may have well been in the path of that storm. And some people lost power. Some people got flooded out. Heard from some of you on Friday night during the SmackDown stream. So I hope everybody is safe and everybody is doing okay and digging themselves out. But that was a very scary storm. If you would like to support the podcast, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. You will find the PayPal link at the top of the page right there. As always, I want to say thank you right off the bat before we get into things here to Big B, Bryant Becerra, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, or as I call him, the King of the Pacific Northwest, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Night Stalker, Nayef, Al Safar, Sweet Sapphire, Sarah Kittleson, Tough Guy, Temjin Zephyr, Killshot, Keith Hart, Sepia Prince, who's been a fan of the show since WrestleMania season in 2016. What's going on, Sepia? And Chris from Bethlehem is celebrating his 39th birthday today. And I'm sorry, brother, I don't know how to tell you this, but Swedish Solo Monster passed away 6 years ago. His wife was a real witch. Just be thankful you never met her. She walked into the bathroom when he was taking a bubble bath one day. He was singing Mamma Mia, plugged their toaster oven into the wall, and tossed it into the tub. It was a horrible way to go. Turns out she thought that she could collect the life insurance money, not realizing that he had stopped paying his premiums months ago. So she ended up not collecting a dime and is currently sitting in a Swedish prison for the next 15 years. So I don't remember how many appearances Swedish Solo Monster made on the podcast. That was a long time ago, but he will never be forgotten. He just can't wish you a happy birthday. So I will. Happy birthday, Chris. And say his name and he reappears. Joe Hendry was originally going to be on the House of Glory show tonight, wrestling Joey Janela. Then he wasn't because TNA had to move its tapings back by a day because of all the bad weather and the storm that was coming in. So, of course, you know, understandable, unfortunate, but not a whole lot that can be done about it. And then TNA moved the tapings back again by a day, and then ultimately they just canceled the tapings altogether. But that freed him up, which means that Joe Hendry is back on the show, and he is wrestling Joey Janela tonight, making his HOG debut is Joe Hendry. So we are very excited to have him. Zilla Fatu will be there as well, defending his Crown Jewel Championship. And Mike Santana will have an open challenge for the HOG World Championship. Who will step up to accept the open challenge? There are some tickets still available. Not many, but there are some. So you can go to hogwrestling.net and pick up your tickets. I'd love to see you guys at the NYC Arena. If not, you can stream the show live at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on Triller TV. Myself and JD from New York will be on the call for the show. Should be a great one. Also, keep in mind, there will be no Tuesday Night Titans this week. Both of us, actually, will be covering NXT on our respective YouTube channels. So, NXT is moving to CW this week, and Julia is wrestling Roxanne Perez on Tuesday for the NXT Women's Championship. In fact, I think that's opening the show. And Trick Williams will battle Ethan Page for the NXT Championship. CM Punk will be on the show, since they are in Chicago. He will be the special guest referee for that match. And who knows who else may show up. Maybe we'll get some machine guns on the show. I don't know. But I will be on YouTube on Monday night, Tuesday night, not Wednesday. I am not covering the five-year anniversary of Dynamite Live because I will not be here. But then back on Friday for SmackDown. Then next Saturday is Bad Blood, which I will be doing a review for live on YouTube after that show is over. And then next Sunday, which is my birthday, what will I be doing? I'll be recording another podcast. That'll be episode 882. So there's going to be a lot of work for me to do this week. And I hope that if nothing else, you will at least tune in and join me for all of the fun. And thank you, as always, for the support. We had a very strong month of September. Hopefully we can do the same in October. Now, as far as this week's episode is concerned, there is a little bit of news, and I will get to that later. But the main topic that we are addressing on the podcast this week, I watched all six episodes of the Mr. McMahon docuseries on Netflix, and this is going to be the main story this week. Bill Simmons did what I thought was a good job with the Andre the Giant HBO documentary a few years ago. Which was made in cooperation with WWE, as this one was, or at least that's how it started. You know, this is one of those classic cases of, like, here's how it started, and here's how it ended. You know, here's how it started, here's how it's going. It was very different at the beginning from where they ended up at the end. But the good thing about him having cooperation from WWE early in the project was that it gave the producers unfettered access to their entire library. And they were able to get all the big names to sit down for interviews, including Vince himself, which was virtually useless, as you'll see. But you had Vince and really all the family members, Vince, Linda, Shane, Stephanie. These were all new interviews from the last, I think they were all generally conducted between 2021 and 2024. They had Bruce Pritchard in there, but they had, you know, big names like Hulk Hogan and Steve Austin, The Rock, Triple H, Cody Rhodes. Bret Hart, Tony Atlas was in there, I guess, just to get the perspective of somebody from that era. So there were a bunch of, Undertaker was another one. So there were a bunch of people who were interviewed for this, in addition to various reporters, Dave Meltzer, Eric Bischoff, other talking heads. But, you know, you come into this and you worry about it being a puff piece. And you worry about it glamorizing a man who does not deserve to be glamorized. You can give him credit for all the things that he's accomplished and achieved, and boy, has he accomplished a lot. But this is not a man that deserves to be glamorized. You worry about them leaving out important parts of the story that deserve to be told, even if it makes him look really bad. You worry about the lies. You worry about the exaggerations. You know, with the Andre documentary, I thought Simmons did a good job of leaving a lot of that out. Bruce Pritchard is one of the people they interviewed for this, and these interviews, again, like I said, some of them go all the way back to 2021. And they came back to Bruce for new interviews at the beginning of this year, right? So now it's 2024. And in this one clip, I believe it was from the last episode, Simmons, you could hear his voice in the background. He asks Bruce if he's seen any of what they have filmed so far. And Pritchard says, yes. And they ask him, so what do you think? And he says, I thought it sucked. He said, I thought it was a gotcha piece. You know, how can you make Vince look bad? And how can you make Vince look shitty? And then he told the story that when his wife got cancer, which was many years ago, Vince made sure she had the best care in the world. And she wasn't even given longer than 4 years to live. And she's still here today, 20 years later. Yes, Vince McMahon has done some nice things in his life. He's treated some of the people closest to him very well, and he's done things for them that we may not have heard about. He took care of the people that his father told him to take care of after his father passed away. Bruce has worked for Vince for most of his life. He's loyal to Vince, so he looks at things through one lens, and that lens tends to get a little foggy when it comes to all the bad shit that Vince McMahon has done or been accused of. He has tunnel vision. He looks straight ahead. He ignores a lot of the stuff to his left and to his right because ignorance is bliss. Having now watched this docuseries, Netflix did nothing to make Vince McMahon look bad. Not one single thing. Bill Simmons did nothing to make Vince McMahon look bad. He did not make up a single thing. Vince McMahon made Vince McMahon look bad. That's a reality that people like Bruce Pritchard can't bring themselves to accept. They choose to see one side of Vince McMahon and either ignore or play down the other side, because it's in their own best interest to do so. In the very first episode, Vince literally says, "Holy shit, if only you knew the real stories. I'll give you just enough to make it semi-interesting, but I don't want anyone to really know me." So what does Bruce expect? When the man is only willing to give you the bare minimum and not let you in enough to see, you know, quote unquote, the real Vince, you can't call it a hit piece. It's just Vince. This is him. This is who he is, and this is what we know of him. These are the stories that we've all heard over all these years. And if there is a side of this man that he does not want people to know about, then that's all we have to go on. That doesn't make it a gotcha piece. A gotcha piece is basically just a catch-all term people use to describe something that they don't like. I put this docuseries squarely in the middle. It's not a gotcha piece, and it's not a puff piece. I thought it was fairly well-balanced on the whole. The biggest mark against it, other than Vince not wanting to really say much of anything interesting, I mean, it was like pulling teeth, is that the majority of these stories and these topics here are ones that every single person listening to this already knew about. And I gotta say, I gotta thank, because I got some messages from people who said, you know, I've been listening to Solo Monsters podcast for, you know, however many years, and he really prepared me for these stories because most, if not all, of the stories that were in this documentary are stories that he's talked about on his show before, which is true. Now that I've watched it, nearly everything in here is stuff that at one time or another, and sometimes more than once, I have covered on this show. All that to say that if you are a wrestling fan and you listen to my show, you listen to other shows, Lapsed Fan, you know, whatever, there's a lot of good podcasts out there. If you listen to these shows, you have probably already heard these stories and you know them chapter and verse. Because we're wrestling fans. And this docuseries is not geared to wrestling fans, so much as it's geared to a more mainstream audience of people who may not know much about Vince McMahon, other than he's that wrestling guy. Yeah, now he's the wrestling guy who allegedly raped and trafficked a woman and paid off a bunch of other women and made them sign non-disclosure agreements. That is forever a part of his legacy now. The other frustrating thing about Vince, and I've always said this, is that if he was more of an open book and actually honest in the things that he says, his life would have made for such a fascinating book or a documentary. But he either lies and exaggerates or he simply doesn't remember a lot of stuff. It's like Hogan. Hulk Hogan is the biggest star in the history of the business. He's had a fascinating life. And he's worked with all the major names in multiple promotions. And if I thought that I could actually believe a word out of the man's mouth, right? Oh, the tales he could tell. But the man lies more than Russo says, bro. Right? That's a lot. So there's a quote from Vince in this documentary. He got called out by Simmons for being hypocritical. Not like in a confrontational way, but he kind of pointed out the hypocrisy of a statement that he made. I think it was on complaining about Ted Turner using his money to buy up all of Vince's talent. And, you know, does he not see what he did in the 80s with the territories as being the same thing? Of course, he doesn't see it the same way, but it is more or less the same thing. I mean, he raided almost every territory of its big names, right? Think of Hulk Hogan and Roddy Piper and the Junkyard Dog. You know, guys like that who were already big stars elsewhere and very well established. He threw money at them to steal them away. And not only steal them away, but in a lot of cases, he would pay them a signing bonus if they left without giving their notice or fulfilling their final dates. So you can say, well, you know, it's just business. It's the free market. I gave them more money and they left for a better opportunity. There's business and there's just being an asshole. But I pulled the quote. This is what Vince said in the documentary. He says, well, what I say a lot of the time is totally different to what I think. And the public doesn't understand that sometimes. As a businessman, you have to throw things out there that's not really the way you feel, but it controls the thought process by doing that. Basically admitting that he says shit that he doesn't actually believe, and he knows it's bullshit, but he says it anyway, and then it's our fault for not seeing things the same way. So he's admitting that we can't take anything he says seriously, or we have to question everything that comes out of his mouth, which is a hell of a thing to say when you have sat down for over 100 hours of interviews. So when you go into this documentary, you need to keep that in mind. You know, does he really believe that The Undertaker did not suffer a concussion at WrestleMania 30? And the real reason he can't remember any of the match is because of the trauma of being told he was losing that night? Yes, he really said this. And no, nobody with any detectable levels of brain activity actually believes that, but he says it anyway. And he left the show early to ride to the hospital with him. Yet he turns around and says something like that. That's the most frustrating part of this entire thing for me. That being said, I thought on the whole, they did a good job with it. It's detailed, yet at the same time, not detailed enough. You know, what starts out as a Vince McMahon documentary kind of morphs into more of a WWE documentary a lot of times than something that's really focused on Vince specifically. They did hit on a lot of the things that I was hoping they would at least briefly talk about, like the Jimmy Snuka stuff, which was very brief, but at least it was mentioned. The Rita Chatterton story, the Zahorian trial, the Ring Boy scandal, the steroid trial, obviously, the death of Owen Hart, Chris Benoit, and the fallout from that. Even Ashley Massaro got a brief mention. I do wish they would have spent more time on Vince's childhood. I have no doubt that that shaped a lot of what he became, for better and for worse. I mean, look, he was the first cadet ever at his military school to be court-martialed. You know, stuff like that was never even mentioned. His early failures. He used to host these oldies concerts. He used to promote them when he was younger. And they got him into a lot of debt. The Evil Knievel Snake River Canyon jump, which was a complete disaster. I mean, 2 years later, he and Linda, they were $1 million in debt and they filed for bankruptcy. Simmons did, to be fair, he did say that they filmed material on the Evil Knievel story and he loved it. It was actually his favorite part of the entire documentary, but they had to cut it for time. He also said they had 4 hours of interviews with Vince that they had to cut just because he came in one day and he sounded like a frog. He had no voice. I mean, he always sounds like a frog now. So imagine it was so bad they couldn't even use it. Imagine what he sounded like that day. But I just don't think you can tell a complete picture of the man's life without getting into those details about the early days. And I'm not just talking his childhood, but I mean like the early days of him doing promoting of like non-wrestling stuff. Instead of just going into, oh, you know, his dad sent him up to Bangor, Maine to promote wrestling shows and they did well. And then he kind of grew from there. Right? That doesn't tell the whole story. Vince McMahon was very fortunate to be born into that family. I mean, he didn't meet his father until he was 12 years old, but you know, he was born into that family. It was in his blood. When he took over from his dad, he had, you know, his dad had the talent. His dad had the established relationships with the venues, including Madison Square Garden, right? The biggest venue of them all, which was their home base. And he had the television clearances for the product. And look, Vince expanded that for sure. He took what he was given. He blew it up even bigger. But when I look back at some of the early failures in his life, if he had been forced to start from scratch on his own, like, you know, start his own wrestling promotion, I don't think it would have succeeded. I don't think we're talking about this. I don't think we're having this conversation right now. And I don't think that his interest in wrestling was such that he would have continued to pursue it. I think he would have just tried to promote other things because I don't think he ever truly loved wrestling to where, well, this is all I ever wanted to do and this is all I ever want to do. Yeah, like I want to be the best wrestling promoter in the world. I don't think that was ever him. I really don't. So much as he wanted to be an entertainment promoter. And if that meant promoting something other than wrestling, then that's what he would have done. And he probably would have failed at that too. So he was very fortunate to have a head start that a lot of other people didn't have. Not blaming him for that. He made the most of the opportunity he was given, but that's just how I feel. And so the way things worked out with him sort of inheriting this, if you take that away and he has to start from the bottom like everybody else, I mean, as driven as he may be and as entrepreneurial as he may be, you know, he was a creative guy. I don't think that he would have had the kind of success that he had in wrestling. And you could see it just with all the other failures outside of wrestling that he had, even after he hit it big in WWE. And we'll get into that as we go along here. Whether it was casinos or restaurants or football leagues or anything else, they were all failures. So as long as you go into this series understanding that we are not the target audience for it, I think you'll enjoy it more. Even though I already knew all of these stories, there were still a few things that surprised me. And I'll get into those, and I'm going to give a quick overview of each episode. But before I do that, there was news coming into this. Because Vince got a sneak peek at the series, and he was not happy with what he saw. 2 days before it dropped, there was a statement from Vince McMahon posted to his Twitter account that said as follows, "I don't regret participating in this Netflix documentary. The producers had an opportunity to tell an objective story about my life and the incredible business that I built, which were equally filled with excitement, drama, fun, and a fair amount of controversy and life lessons. Unfortunately, based on an early partial cut that I've seen, this doc falls short and takes the predictable path of conflating the Mr. McMahon character with my true self, Vince." Yeah, you know, the true self that in the documentary he said he doesn't want to let us in on. That Vince. Says, "The title and promos alone make that evident. A lot has been misrepresented or left out entirely in an effort to leave viewers intentionally confused. The producers use typical editing tricks with out-of-context footage and dated sound bites to distort the viewer's perception and support a deceptive narrative. In an attempt to further their misleading account, the producers use a lawsuit based on an affair I ended as evidence that I am, in fact, Mr. McMahon. I hope the viewer will keep an open mind and remember that there are two sides to every story." The funniest part about that is that in the documentary, they asked the question, are Vince and Mr. McMahon one and the same? And Vince says, no, absolutely not. Then they cut to Hulk Hogan and Shawn Michaels, and I think Shane and even Bruce. And they all say, yeah, basically Vince and Mr. McMahon are the same person. We're very close to each other. Again, you can't take anything he says at face value. You know, he said it himself. These are the people that have worked with him for years, and they admit that, yes, he is Mr. McMahon. I mean, Bill Simmons should have sent him a gift basket for that tweet because it was a better advertisement for this documentary than anything he could have paid for. So Janelle Grant's attorney followed. She, of course, is the one who filed the sex trafficking suit against him earlier this year. And Grant's attorney posted the following statement of her own. Actually, a couple of statements. The first one before Netflix dropped the doc. She said, "Vince McMahon physically and emotionally abused, sexually assaulted, and human trafficked Janelle Grant for more than 2 years. Calling his horrific and criminal behavior an affair is delusional and nothing more than a sad attempt to save his shredded reputation. Although Ms. Grant has not seen the Mr. McMahon docuseries, we hope that it shines a bright light on his abhorrent and criminal actions by accurately portraying the realities of his abusive and exploitative behavior. Ms. Grant will no longer be silenced by McMahon. Her story, though deeply troubling and exceptionally painful, is one that can help other abuse survivors find their voices. We seek to hold McMahon, John Laurinaitis, and WWE accountable and to give Ms. Grant her day in court." And after the series was released, Ann Callis followed with one more statement. "The Mr. McMahon docuseries makes it clear there is no difference between Vince McMahon's on-air persona and his true self. They are one and the same. His quote-unquote character, known for violent outbursts, sexual deviance, and manipulation, is the real Vince McMahon and exactly what Janelle Grant experienced behind closed doors at WWE for years. While the docuseries puts McMahon's obsession with power and control on full display, it only scratches the surface of his criminal behavior and it fails to tell the full story of his abuse, sexual assault, and human trafficking of Ms. Grant. She deserves the opportunity to tell her story on her own time and in her own way. We look forward to her day in court and to seeing McMahon at last held accountable for his actions." Now, Vince also parted ways with Citric and Company, which is a pretty prominent public relations firm that he hired in April for crisis management to try to help him repair his image. Yeah, good luck with that. I said on TNT Tuesday night, I would be very curious if he hired a new firm just recently, like in the last couple of weeks, because him posting that statement on Twitter, it just felt like a new strategy because he doesn't post on social media very often. And sure enough, the very next day, it was revealed that he did indeed hire a new firm to replace Citric, That would be Edendale Strategies, which is also a crisis management firm. This man's entire life is a crisis. Then we learned from a report by Matthew Bologna of Puck News that Vince tried to buy the series away from Netflix. The report says that after seeing early footage, McMahon actually tried to buy the project back from Netflix, per two sources familiar with the matter. Vince also had Endeavor CEO Ari Emanuel, his new partner in TKO, chime in on his behalf, also voicing concern about the doc's treatment of Vince's alter ego, Mr. McMahon, which ended up being the title of the documentary. Netflix refused to let the project go, and then this past January, an even worse McMahon scandal broke when a former employee sued, alleging terrible abuse. None of this surprises me at all. Vince McMahon is a control freak. And when he is not in control, when there is a narrative about him that he cannot control, instinctively, he tries to kill it. Even though he himself agreed to sit down for 100 hours worth of interviews. He didn't have to do that. Nobody forced him to do that. He could have said, no, I don't want to have any part of this. You're going to have to make it without me. Or I'm not going to give you access to my archives. He didn't do that. But it doesn't fit my narrative of how I want people to view me, so I'll just buy it and bury it. The old catch and kill. And Netflix, in so many words, to their credit, told him to fuck off. We're not for sale. He did the same thing to the guys attached to that Pandemonium biopic. I talked about it on the podcast at the time. It was like 2017, 2018. They were going to do a movie on his life. And after he got on board with the project, ultimately, he killed it. So he's pulled this crap before. This is not the first time. But the first episode, it focused on Vince's early days and taking over the territory from his father, stomping out all the other territories and the success of the first WrestleMania. They talked about him growing up poor, living in a trailer park with his mom and his stepfather who abused him. Now, he did not actually meet Vince Sr. until he was 12. They did not touch on Vince in his infamous Playboy interview from 20 years ago, implying that his mother may have sexually abused him. He went on Howard Stern, I don't think it was long after that, and when Howard brought that up, he acted like, well, you know, I never actually said that, but I mean, you know, he kind of danced around it. He clearly implied that in the interview. So, I mean, if that didn't happen, what a fucked up thing for his mother, you know, if he lied about that. It's just one of those things where if you're going to say that, I understand him not wanting to get into it if he was abused. Totally understandable. But if you're going to throw it out there like that and you're going to bring it up or lead people to kind of lead you on and it's like, oh my God, are you saying what I think you're saying? And you don't deny it, but it didn't actually happen. That's pretty fucked up. So I'm going to assume that something did happen to him as far as the, you know, family members that he's referring to. Now, his stepfather was not a good man, and he once said that it was unfortunate that he died before he had the chance to kill him because he would have enjoyed that. So he clearly went through some serious shit when he was younger and should have gone to therapy, but he never did. Scott Hall is another one. He used to be a bartender. He shot a man to death in the parking lot in self-defense. And then years later, he was diagnosed with PTSD. And he said the biggest mistake of his life, this is when they did the ESPN 30 for 30, he said the biggest mistake of his life was not seeking counseling right after that. But he didn't know any better. He was like 25 years old, and he didn't know any better. That, and also probably it wasn't the macho thing to do back then, but I do wonder how many of these people would have turned out differently had they sought help instead of repressing this stuff. Gorilla Monsoon was the heir apparent to the company to take over the business until Vince made a deal with his dad. Now Monsoon was one of several shareholders, but Vince made a deal with his dad, and it wasn't a bad deal if you were one of the shareholders. You sell your shares to him, sell them to Junior, and if he misses even one payment, control of the business reverts back to the shareholders, and you don't have to pay back any of the money that Vince already paid you. So for people like Monsoon, even if Vince didn't miss a payment and took over, and let's say, okay, he really did take over the company, he knew he would be taken care of and he would have a job for life. That was something that Vince's father wanted. He wanted to make sure those guys were taken care of, and they were. Then he went from territory to territory, and if he didn't kill them outright, he certainly sped up their demise. And, you know, those promoters had a hand in their own demise, too. You can't just say that Vince killed all the territories as if the promoters themselves had nothing to do with it. It's like saying Vince killed WCW. You know, and I know Vince McMahon himself loves to say that. I beat my competition. I killed WCW. No, he helped speed up their demise. But ultimately, WCW killed WCW. WCW committed suicide. That's what happened to WCW. It was death by a thousand cuts. AOL Time Warner helped kill WCW more than Vince McMahon ever did. You know, Vern Gagne not putting the AWA world title on Hulk Hogan and committing to him as the champion. Think of all those dusty finishes that he did where Hogan would beat Nick Bockwinkel, but then later on they would take the title away from him, right? That helped kill the AWA. Had Vern gone all in on Hogan, who knows how different things might have been, right? Now, Vern didn't have the vision of, like, national expansion that McMahon did, so I'm not saying that, you know, it would have been the AWA on MTV, and it would have been the AWA on NBC, but he bears a lot of that responsibility, too, for what happened to his promotion. But they didn't even talk about Vince personally going into some of these markets with a briefcase full of money to the local television affiliate and paying off the program directors to air WWF shows over whatever the local wrestling programming was that they aired. That was something else that he did to try to kill them off. You know, Vince here said that he considered Dusty Rhodes for the Hulk Hogan spot as his next champion and the face of the company, but Dusty didn't want to do it. Didn't work out. Which sounds strange, you know, for a guy like Vince who was so obsessed with, like, these big hulking physiques. Why would he choose Dusty as his guy? But Cody has said that Dusty used to tell him the same story, and he didn't believe it. He just thought it was Dusty being Dusty. Until one day, I think it was when he was still Stardust, he was backstage talking to Vince, and Vince told him the same thing. He said, oh, it could have been Dusty instead of Hogan, but it didn't work out. I don't think it would have worked as well, nearly as well, as it did with Hogan. Hogan was the perfect guy for that role at the perfect time. Dusty was charismatic, but so was Hogan. And Hogan had something Dusty didn't, which was the look and the size that just made him look like a comic book hero. And that's what Vince loved, and that's what people wanted to see. I mean, that's why it was the golden age of action movies and action heroes like Stallone and Schwarzenegger. You know, Hogan was kind of cut from the same mold. He was a product of his time. And Hogan is all over this documentary. There he was, you know, talking about him and Andre selling out Shea Stadium, which was not sold out, nor were they the main attraction on the show that night that brought in the gate. That was Bruno Sammartino and Larry Zbysko, but Hogan being Hogan. He talked about getting the part of Thunder Lips in Rocky III, and Vince Sr. warning him that if you take the role, you're gone, you're going to be blackballed, I'm never going to have you back here again. Which is, I mean, it's nonsensical. I'm not saying he didn't say that, but it's just nonsensical that, you know, someone who looked like Hogan would just be blackballed and would never be hired again. I don't think that would have been the case. And he did come back, and it was Vince Jr. who brought him back, and they put the title on the Iron Sheik to help transition the title from Bob Backlund to Hulk Hogan. And my favorite part was Bruce Prichard talking about American nationalism, you know, back in the 80s, and how big it was. Because you had, oh yeah, all the foreign heels, you know, Germans and Japanese and Iranians. And I mean, if you were foreign, you were probably playing a heel at the time. And they're showing all of these menacing foreign heels. And they show the clip of Doc Brown being gunned down by the Libyans in Back to the Future. I was like, wow, where'd that come from? But, you know, all the old Hogan footage still had Eye of the Tiger playing instead of dubbing in. And I love Real American, but I mean, it's ridiculous when they do these music dubs. And they didn't do that here. They had Eye of the Tiger playing, so that was cool to hear. They covered the first WrestleMania and the chance meeting that Lou Albano had with Cyndi Lauper. They were sitting together on an airplane, and that led to her getting involved in wrestling. And, of course, Albano appeared in the Girls Just Want to Have Fun music video. As important as Mr. T was to the success of that first WrestleMania, Cyndi Lauper was just as important. I mean, she was such a big star at that time. They covered the John Stossel incident where Dr. D, David Schultz, open hand slapped the shit out of him in the ear. Not once, but twice. Let me make sure you hear it in both ears. When Stossel dared to suggest that wrestling was fake. I'm not going to lie, that still gives me pleasure, no matter how many times I watch it. They had footage of the incident where Hulk Hogan choked out Richard Belzer on his TV show when they were going around promoting WrestleMania. I just covered this on the podcast, what was it, a few weeks ago? Belzer sued him for $5 million, and they settled out of court years later. And Belzer ended up taking that money and buying a house in France with the money from the suit. It's the same house that he died in last year. The most expensive front chin lock ever applied. And that was pretty much it for episode one. Again, I wish there was more meat on the bone as far as Vince before joining his father's company, but it is what it is. And most of these episodes are in the hour range. Some of them are longer than an hour. Some of them are a little bit less. And that's probably the way it's going to be when Raw moves to Netflix in January, where not every episode will be 3 hours. Some of them may be 3:10. Some of them may be 2:40. You would think on Netflix they would have the flexibility to run a little short, run a little long. You know, they don't have a hard stop like they do on USA Network. Episode 2 is where things got a little more interesting with all the scandals. The first big revelation, and it isn't really a revelation that Hogan did this, but it's the first time I can ever remember him actually admitting to it on camera. That he was the one who ratted out Jesse Ventura to Vince McMahon when he tried to organize a union right before WrestleMania 2. Hogan and Jesse were actually very good friends, and they worked together in the AWA. Eventually, they both migrated to WWE, and they were friendly until after Jesse had already left Vince in 1990. Even up to that point, they were friends, and it wasn't until Jesse's lawyer deposed Vince McMahon in a lawsuit that was more about royalties. It had nothing to do with any of this, but in a deposition, you can have your lawyer ask whatever you want. So Jesse said to his lawyer, hey, ask Vince how he found out about me trying to organize that union years ago. So the lawyer asked Vince, and without blinking an eye, Vince, under oath, said, Hulk Hogan told me. And Jesse was floored. Like, he had no idea. And from that day on, Jesse has hated Hogan's guts. It's no surprise that, you know, Jesse's time in WCW, he came into WCW in 92. And it just so happened that Jesse left WCW right at the moment, I think the same month that Hogan came into the company. You think that was a coincidence? Vince said he doesn't think anyone in the locker room would have supported Jesse anyway, which is exactly the kind of thing I would expect Vince McMahon to say. And I'm not even saying that it would have ultimately succeeded. Could you get all the wrestlers to agree and get on board and actually have a union? Probably not. But nobody else of note, nobody else with a name like Jesse had back then has had the fucking balls since then to even try such a thing. And nobody ever will, because now they've got guaranteed contracts and they're making more money than they've ever made before. And the schedule is not nearly as grueling as it was back then. It was basically inhumane back then. So why would any of the top names want to rock the boat? Why would any of them want to rock the boat? You know, Hogan was the clear number one at the time. He didn't want anything that would have jeopardized his spot because he's selfish. But that selfishness is a big part of what kept him on top for so long. Vince told the story of approaching Andre the Giant on the set of The Princess Bride that he was filming go ahead and have back surgery because we want you to come back and we want you to wrestle Hogan. I've got this vision for a huge match. You're going to have to go heel. But it would be you and Hogan at WrestleMania 3. And he's always told the story as Andre got the surgery so that he could wrestle Hogan. But in fact, Andre did not get the surgery before the match with Hogan. He got the surgery in July of 87, which was a whole 4 months after the match. Because it took that long, it took exactly that long for them to assemble the operating room just to operate on this guy and all the tools that they had to create from scratch. All the instruments, scalpels, and everything big enough to open this big fucker up because he was so gigantic. They had to cut his back open. They had to widen his spine to relieve the pressure from the spinal stenosis that he was dealing with. This was all revealed in Pat LaPrade's, he has this great book on Andre's life. And he got access to a lot of things, a lot of documents, Andre's working permit paperwork. So this is right from the source. So that flies in the face a little bit as far as the story Vince has always told. But of course, WrestleMania 3 with Meltzer on here, they got into the debate about the WrestleMania 3 attendance. Now, Meltzer has always said 78,000 because Zane Breslov, who was the local promoter at the time for WWE, and he worked for WCW later, he was, you know, friends with Meltzer, and Meltzer has always told the story that he was talking to Zane on the phone, and Breslov was like, hey, you want to know what the real attendance was for WrestleMania? Because Meltzer, for years in The Observer, had promoted that it was 93,000. This is what some people don't understand. Dave was reporting 93,000 in The Observer for like 4 or 5 years. And then one day he's having a conversation with Breslov and he's like, hey, you want to know what the real attendance was? And he's like, what? And I think it was the paperwork that he showed him at the time that said 78,000. Vince, of course, has always said 93,000. Now, I think the paid number was probably 78,000. And when you include everybody who is actually in the building, including people who work there. Like, this is what they did for WrestleMania in Dallas 32 when they claimed 101,000, right? They included everybody. They included the fucking police in the parking lot in that number. And even still, it was an exaggerated number, clearly. As far as WrestleMania 3, what was the actual number of people in the building? We'll never know for sure. I'm sure it was over 80,000. Vince himself, over the years, has said that the numbers they announce for these shows are for entertainment purposes. Okay, that comes straight from the horse's mouth. And we know a lot of these WrestleMania numbers are exaggerated by, you know, 10, 15,000. So I'm not really sure why it's hard for some people to believe that the 93,000 number would be exaggerated, just like so many of these other numbers are also exaggerated. Do I believe that it was 93,000? No, I don't. But who cares? It was still a shitload of people. There were a lot of people there. Remember that bird's eye view shot that they got? Everybody looks like ants. I mean, there were so many people there. But I mean, everything about that match was worked. So why wouldn't the attendance be worked also? Right? They said Andre was undefeated coming into that match. He wasn't. They said Andre had never been slammed before. That was a lie. But it's all part of the lore and the myth of the match. That match is still the biggest attraction in the history of the business. Hogan versus Andre, and that image of Hogan slamming Andre, is iconic. Nothing will ever take away from that. If there was one match that I wish I could have been in the building for live to experience, it's that slam in Hogan versus Andre. My number two would be Rock Hogan from the Sky Dome. You know, Hogan was on the Barstool Sports podcast the other day, told his usual WrestleMania 3 story about lifting Andre up for the slam and tearing all of the muscles in his body. Hogan being Hogan. Hogan and Vince then worked together on the movie No Holds Barred a few years later, and actually it was the following year. I think they worked on it in 88, movie came out in 89. That's why they put the title on Savage. Hogan had to go away to film a movie, so Savage got his run and actually did quite well. But Hogan and Vince went off to go work on the movie together, and they wrote it, and of course the one clip from the movie they showed here was the worst scene in the entire movie, where Hogan has that guy by the shirt, and he asks, "What's that smell?" And the guy says, "Dookie." God. I mean, that scene just hits different now after the Janelle Grant stuff, I will tell you. So they got into the Dr. Zahorian scandal. Dr. George Zahorian, he was a doctor appointed by the Pennsylvania State Athletic Commission to cover the WWF shows. And he was prescribing steroids and all sorts of other drugs to the talent. Bret Hart has described it as, there would be a line outside of his office at the shows where the boys would collect their candy. They'd walk out of there with grocery bags full of shit. And this went on for years, and what they don't cover here is that there were some people within the company who knew that Zahorian was trouble, and they didn't want him there, including one woman who warned people like Pat Patterson and Linda McMahon that, look, this guy is trouble. I really don't want to bring him in as the doctor anymore. Pat Patterson is the one who told this woman, look, the boys need their candies. Keep booking him. And Linda told her, look, do whatever Pat says. They were actually talking about putting him on their payroll. They were going to bring him officially on board, but then Linda got a tip. She got a hot tip. From who exactly, or who funneled that tip to her attorney, we'll never know. But there was a tip that she got about a drug investigation that the government was about to launch. And she went to Pat. And Patterson then called Zahorian and told him, are you in your office? And he was like, yes. And Patterson said, go to a payphone and call me back. Which is totally normal behavior when one calls their doctor on the phone, of course. And he tipped off Zahorian about this investigation. And he told him, look, destroy any and all records that you kept on the wrestlers. None of this was mentioned. But Zahorian was indicted. He was convicted. He ended up going to prison for a few years. And you will be happy to know that Dr. Zahorian is still a practicing urologist in the state of Pennsylvania to this day. They showed Hogan going on the Arsenio Hall show, which was another low point, and lying about his steroid use. I don't use steroids. I used steroids 3 times in my life, all to heal injuries. I don't do steroids. Even though he says that Vince told him to go on the show and just tell the truth. Then they have this great clip from the interview they did with Vince of him saying that it's just easier to tell the truth. That was rich. I laughed out loud at that one. Just tell the truth, right? It will set you free. The truth will set you free. Actually, in the case of Vince these days, I think if he told the truth, it would probably lead to the opposite of freedom for him. So he's probably better keeping his mouth shut. They got Phil Mushnick, the New York Post columnist, to sit down for an interview. Mushnick was a thorn in Vince's side for years and years and years. I don't like Phil Mushnick either. I used to check out his columns sometimes in the Post, and I mean, the guy was just fucking miserable about everything. But it is clear that Vince and Pritchard and all of them, they hate his guts because he was saying things at the time that were not in their best interest and made the company look bad. And that's not a journalist's job or a columnist's job, is to make their company look good. He was reporting on things that nobody else in the mainstream media was. And that wasn't something that they were used to, because wrestling was still the freak show attraction that people didn't take seriously. You think wrestling got legitimate, serious mainstream media coverage in the way it does today? Today, it's a different story. Today, you get WrestleMania and WWE covered on fucking SportsCenter. It wasn't like that back in the day. And when they did get press, it was usually fluff pieces. So they weren't used to it. So that's the real reason why they didn't like Phil Mushnick. And he would cover things that really needed to be taken seriously, because there was some seriously bad shit going on that deserved more attention. So this is where they very briefly touched on Jimmy Snuka's mistress mysteriously dying on the road and the medical examiner classifying her death as a homicide. But no charges were ever brought. Meltzer says it's fair to assume that Vince McMahon may have had something to do with that. You know, Snuka was the biggest star in the company at that time. He was never pushed at that level again after that. And, I mean, they used to run Allentown for their tapings all the time back then. They were a constant presence in Allentown. They brought business to Allentown. It's fair to assume that something fishy happened. What that is, we'll never know. That Dark Side of the Ring episode where they interviewed the chief of police at the time, that didn't exactly inspire a lot of confidence. But with Vince, you know, one thing that he made very clear in this documentary is that he's all about business and protecting his business. Do I think that he would be capable of covering up a murder to protect one of his top stars? Yes, I do. They devoted more coverage to the Ring Boy scandal than they did the Snuka thing, which rightfully so. I mean, the Ring Boy scandal was horrendous. I mean, it could get its own Dark Side of the Ring episode like Snuka did, except most of the people involved now are all dead. Mel Phillips was the head of the ring crew. He was the ring boss, and he was one of the ring announcers for the company at that time. Bret Hart comes right out, because Bret doesn't sugarcoat shit. He comes right out and says, Mel Phillips was a total pedophile. This is the same Mel Phillips that Vince McMahon fired because he thought he had an unnatural relationship with kids. Then he turned around, I think almost instantly, and rehired him with the understanding that he stay away from kids. So this notion that things were happening on his watch and Vince was just blind to it all, he had no idea. Right? As he tried to convince everybody on the Phil Donahue show of that, it doesn't pass the smell test. It's never passed the smell test. It will never pass the smell test. And then came the Rita Chatterton story. I didn't think that anything would be said about this that would shock me, because I didn't think anything was going to be said that I didn't already know. And news-wise, there wasn't. But then Vince opened his mouth and proved me wrong. Rita Chatterton was the first ever female referee in WWE. She went by the name of Rita Marie. She accused Vince of raping her in the back of his limousine in 1986. And at the time, like the next day, she told some wrestlers about it. I think Mario Mancini may have been one of them. Andre may have been another. So she did say something to some people about it at the time. But otherwise, she stayed quiet about it for, I think, 5 years before she went public. And she said that the reason she waited that long, she wanted to wait until her parents passed away, because she didn't want them to know about what had happened. Or maybe they were old and it was, you know, she didn't want to, you know, hurt their health, whatever the reason was. Once they passed on, that's when she went public with what happened to her. And she said that she was forced to perform oral sex on him and was told that if she wanted $500,000 a year contract, that she would have to satisfy him. Now, Vince has always claimed that the incident never happened. Here, he said it was consensual. So, you know, saying that they had sex, but it was a totally consensual thing. Then, now, if he would have left it right there, it's like, okay, that's been his story for years. She says she was raped. He says it was consensual. And that's the way it's kind of left. But then he followed that by saying that, well, if it actually had been a rape, the statute of limitations had already run out anyway, so it's just all kinds of crap that people are digging up. My jaw dropped when he said that. I could not believe those words came out of his mouth. What would possess an innocent person to ever answer that question in that way? I didn't do it, but if I had, I can't be prosecuted for it anyway, so why are people talking about this anymore? It gave off very strong O.J. Simpson, if I did it, vibes, for those of you who remember that whole fiasco. What a stupid fucking thing to say. Meanwhile, he paid her off finally last year when New York was about to lift the statute of limitations. It was a very brief window, but they were going to lift the statute of limitations, which they did, for victims of sex abuse, and Chatterton would have been able to pursue a case against McMahon because it happened in New York State. So he settled with her for millions of dollars. Exactly how much, I don't think it was ever reported, but it was in the millions. So from there, they got into the feds coming after Vince for steroid distribution. Mushnick admitted to being an FBI informant. I don't know if he was admitting to anything formal, per se, or just that the FBI was informed by the articles that he was writing. I assume that's what he meant. One big revelation came from Kay Koplowitz. She was the head of USA Network at the time. She sat for an interview. She said that had Vince been found guilty in that trial, they would have had no choice but to cancel all WWF programming on USA. And think about how that would have changed the business. No WWF on USA means no Monday Night War. Maybe no NWO, no Attitude Era. That would have been a massive blow for them to lose their TV. Enter Ted Turner and WCW. They signed Hulk Hogan at the same time the government wants Hogan to be their star witness against Vince, or else Hogan could potentially end up doing years in prison. He ends up getting immunity. And instead of giving the government what they were hoping for, he testifies that Vince never told him to take steroids. And Bret Hart and many others have said the same thing. It's one of those things where he might tell you something like, oh, you need to work out more, you need to get bigger. But he never outright told people, you need to get on the juice. You know, you need to get on the gas, pal. It's that plausible deniability. He knew his wrestlers were on steroids. He even admitted to taking them himself. But they had no smoking gun proof that he ever explicitly sold them himself or told people to take them. And that's where the government's case fell apart and he was acquitted. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. When you're a kid, you learn new things every day from your parents, from your teachers. Everything you do, you're learning something. As adults, though, we sometimes lose that curiosity. Me? I've wanted to learn a new language. I took Spanish for 6 years in school because I had to, and I'm still not conversational in it. But they have all these apps now. I really want to jump back on the train and try again. These past few months, I've learned a lot when it comes to graphics work. You can see it in the thumbnails and the layouts every week on the YouTube channel. I learn from the best. For you, therapy can help you reconnect with your sense of wonder because, again, you're never too old to learn something new. Therapy can improve your life in some pretty amazing ways, whether it's something as simple as how to be more productive or dealing with something more serious that may be causing a lot of stress in your life. Therapy can teach you the coping skills that you need to break through that ceiling. It can help you be the best version of yourself. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to fit into your schedule, no matter how busy you think you may be. All you do to get started is just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and have peace of mind, knowing that you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Rediscover your curiosity with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Solomonster today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Solomonster. In the third episode, they spent a lot of time on the Monday Night War, which is everything that you've already heard ad nauseum, including Eric Bischoff's story about the meeting with Ted Turner. He looks over at one of the other executives and he tells them, give Eric 2 hours every Monday night on TNT, even though Nitro was a 1 hour show for the first 9 months, but it's a nice story. There was a lot of stuff here. The curtain call incident being one of them that just felt out of place in a documentary that's supposed to be about Vince McMahon's life. But there was one part that was just priceless. Vince is crying about Ted Turner throwing his money around and stealing all of his talent and trying to put him out of business. Bischoff and Meltzer, they had a nice laugh about this, and they both pointed out the hypocrisy of Vince whining about this when he did more or less the same thing to the territories in the 80s. And it's rare that you get Eric Bischoff and Dave Meltzer to agree on anything, but they agree on that. You could hear Simmons off camera. He's pushing back on that. And Vince says, well, it's not the same thing. He says, Ted wanted to hurt us, whereas I just wanted to compete. Really? Was he just kidding when he told Crockett that he would choke on that $1 million when he sold him the TBS time slot after Black Saturday? Was he not trying to hurt them when he counter-programmed the first Survivor Series against Starrcade and then threatened the cable companies that if they carried Starrcade, he would not let them air WrestleMania 4? Or how about when he programmed the first Royal Rumble as a free TV special opposite their Bunkhouse Stampede pay-per-view? Was he only trying to compete when he threatened the promoters in the other territories that they either let him buy out their offices or that he would put them all out of business? Yes, he's a hypocrite. The only question is, does he really believe what he says, or shall we go back to the quote from earlier that he says things that he doesn't necessarily believe? It's like he's just not used to being challenged on these things, so he doesn't have a good answer for any of it. It's like when he did the HBO Real Sports episode back in 03, and he smacked the papers out of Armin Katan's hands, and they had footage of that here in the special in one of the later episodes, and he smacks the papers out of the reporter's hands when he dared ask if he felt that, you know, Vince, does Vince feel any sense of responsibility for the early deaths of some of the wrestlers who worked for him? And even if you agree that Vince wasn't responsible, right? I mean, many of them worked for other promoters too before they even came to work for WWF. No well-adjusted human being would react the way that he did on that show, right? With the pouty lips and smacking the papers out of his hand. They're talking about people dying here. We're talking about wrestlers not making it to the age of 40. An epidemic of death in an industry where he happens to run the biggest and most prominent company in the business. It's a fair question, and you can answer it like a normal person, but of course Vince McMahon is not a normal person. They covered Hogan turning heel and joining the NWO, which is something Vince said he never considered, is turning Hogan heel. You know, in a perfect world, Hogan goes heel in 92. maybe even in late 92. And they build to him putting over Brett sometime in 93 and passing the torch. I mean, since they ended up going with Brett anyway, you know, even if he wasn't their first choice, like Lex Luger was. But Hogan was never going to do that. And the sad thing is, Hogan could have done that, and Hogan would have been just fine. You know, like if they turn him heel and he put a few people over, eventually he could have turned babyface again a few years later, and he would have been the biggest thing in the entire wrestling world again. Like, what's old is new again. But it's like the John Cena thing, I guess, where they just felt, and part of it, I'm sure, was Hogan just, you know, being leery about doing it, even though now, of course, he's like, oh, I wanted to turn heel after WrestleMania 6. He told that story on Barstool Sports last week, too. Oh, yeah, I told Vince, man, let me attack the Ultimate Warrior after he beats me at WrestleMania 6, and I'll become Triple H. I'll become a Hollywood Hulk Hogan. He's been telling that story the past few years. But I think it was more a case of Vince looking at Hogan like Hogan's the golden goose. It's the same reason he didn't want to turn John Cena, right? All the merch money they would have lost. And even here, Vince said, no, he didn't think Hogan would work as a heel. It was such a, it would have been like sacrilege. He was such a babyface. The fans never would have embraced him as the bad guy, which obviously turned out to be very wrong. But Vince could have had that. He could have had heel Hogan. He just chose not to do it. Eric Bischoff did. It covered the Montreal Screwjob, and to watch this, you would think that Bret Hart just simply did not want to lose the title. You know, he woke up one day and said, nope, I'm not losing the belt. And how dare he go against tradition? And this, of course, ignores the fact that he actually offered to drop the belt to any number of people, including Steve Austin, or the fucking Brooklyn Brawler. He said he would lose the title to him at Madison Square Garden. Just not to Shawn Michaels in Montreal that night, because Shawn told him months earlier that he would not be willing to do the same for Brett. Brett said, I'm willing to do business and put you over. And Shawn's response should have been, I appreciate that, brother. I would do the same for you. He did the exact opposite. That would have pissed me off too. But even more than that, they failed to mention that Bret Hart had creative control in his contract for the last 60 days. Which, if you think about it, was a very interesting thing to have his lawyer put in there, considering that he had just signed a 20-year deal with the company less than a year earlier. So you know that Brett is looking at this going, I'm a lifer. I'm never leaving this company. I just signed a 20-year deal, right? By the time that deal is over, I'll be an executive in the company. I won't even be wrestling anymore. So, like, why would he have, unless it was his lawyer's idea, why would he even have that put in the contract, right? Maybe it was a hunch. I don't know. But none of that was ever mentioned. And I think that's a pretty important detail to the story. But out of the Montreal Screwjob came the Mr. McMahon character. And the Mr. McMahon character, I maintain, is the greatest heel in the history of pro wrestling. And that led into episode 4, which focused on the Attitude Era, which was, you know, a product of its time. I look back on some of the stuff from the Attitude Era today, and they had a lot of footage of it here in this documentary. And there's a lot of it that I cringe, you know, looking back on. Some of it I look back on and it still gives me goosebumps in the best of ways, right? Some of it is just priceless. And I love going back and watching some of those moments. It is a mixed bag, though. And I do think that it's true that it's not entirely fair to judge a lot of this stuff, you know, based on 2024 eyes in the same way that it would have been judged back then, because again, it was a different time, which is not to excuse some of the stuff that they did, but you can't judge it the same way. So then we have the rise of Stone Cold Steve Austin in The Rock. Pritchard tells the bullshit story of how Austin cut the Austin 316 speech at the King of the Ring, and the very next night on Raw, here's a sea of Austin 316 signs. That never happened. Not only did that not happen, the man couldn't even get on the SummerSlam card 2 months later after winning King of the Ring. He was stuck on the pre-show. Then later on, they brought in Mike Tyson. This is skipping ahead to 98 now, and there's this embarrassing clip. I'd never seen this before. There is an embarrassing clip from 2013 with Stephanie McMahon. She's being interviewed by somebody, and she was asked if she thought it was a risk bringing Tyson in, given all the baggage that he brought. And she turns to somebody off camera, and she says, well, I thought that, you know, like the rape case hadn't happened yet by that point when we brought him in. when in fact it did many years earlier. So that was embarrassing. Then they got into the death of Owen Hart. And this is always tough to watch here. It was tough to watch the Dark Side of the Ring episode on it, and it was tough to watch it here, even though it was a very condensed version. It was condensed because this is not about Owen, but it was most definitely a controversial decision for Vince to continue on with the show that night even after he died. Brett says that he thinks they sabotaged Owen's career and tried to bury him as a way of getting back at him and the way he left the company. You know, it's one thing to believe that, and I don't agree at all. Like, even the Blue Blazer character he was doing at the time of his death, that was in 99. That was 2 years after Brett left the company. Like, why would they care enough at that point to bury Owen just to get back at Brett? But whatever. Maybe Brett honestly thinks they sabotage Owen and his push to get back at him. That's one thing. It's an entirely different thing for Brett to say, as he did here, that the thought had crossed his mind at the time that they intentionally murdered his brother as a way to get back at him, which is just an incredibly self-absorbed, just insane thing for him to say. And I say that as a fan of Brett. That is one of the stupidest things that I have heard in my entire life. Now, he doesn't feel that way now, thank God. And look, I get that he was grieving the loss of his little brother, but even still, when your first thought is, oh, maybe they killed him to get back at me, it just sounds like you're so far up your own ass, you think Monday is Wednesday. Should Vince have continued the show? No, he should not have. That's an easy call to make in retrospect. In the moment, should the show have been stopped? Yes, it still should have been stopped. It was a crime scene. This is the thing I don't get. Like, the ring was a crime scene. It should have been roped off once they got him out of there. For that reason alone, I don't know how they allowed that show to go on, let alone all the talent. I don't know how they kept it together after that. I really don't. I mean, what a horrible thing, you know, going out to the ring, having to perform in front of all these people, and you look over and you know that your friend, your coworker died right there on the mat in the corner. You know, Jerry Lawler, when he sat back down at the announce desk next to JR, as they were still working on Owen in the ring, he had gone over to check on him. He knew. Just go take a look at his face. He knew that Owen was dead. He was still in the ring. He was dead. They talked about the family dynamic with Shane and Stephanie, and Stephanie refusing to do an incest storyline with her father. She didn't even want to talk about it here. She's already talked about this on, it might have been the McMahon DVD many years ago. Here, they asked her if she was ever asked to do anything very weird or uncomfortable, and she was like, yeah, I'm not going to, you know, there's one thing I'm not going to talk about. Then they cut to Vince, and Vince was like, yeah, I'll tell you about it. And what it was an incest storyline. She was pregnant at the time. And the storyline was going to be that her father would be revealed as the one who got her pregnant. You can hide behind the veil of, oh, it's just entertainment, all you want to, but the signs have always been there. What a sick fuck this guy is. What they forgot to mention is that when Stephanie shot down that idea, his next suggestion was that Shane should be revealed as the one who got his sister pregnant, which was also shot down. Stephanie also refused to allow her wedding to be broadcast live on pay-per-view, to which Vince told his daughter she was being selfish. And then he booked himself in a street fight with her 6 days before her wedding. They covered the Trish Stratus storyline where she became Vince's on-screen love interest. Vince was asked if any of the family members had a problem with it, where he would be making out with Trish on TV right in front of Linda, who was, you know, all drugged up in a comatose state sitting in a wheelchair. And Vince was like, no, none of them had any problems with it. Immediately they cut to Shane, who says he had a problem with it. So, like, I gotta say, the editing on this entire documentary was great. Like, there were multiple instances like this where Vince would say one thing and they would immediately cut to five other people saying the exact opposite. I know Bruce Pritchard would sit there and go, oh, see, that's the gotcha part that I'm talking about. That's the gotcha part, right? No, it's called fact-checking. Like, these are his family members. These are the people closest to him who know him better than anybody in the world. And they are saying, no, actually, it's the exact opposite of what he's saying. And they included the segment where he made Trish get down on all fours and bark like a dog and strip down to her panties. They did not include Paul Heyman's line on commentary where he said, "Hey, Mom, I came to Washington, D.C., and I'm going to get to see Bush." They didn't include that. Trish was interviewed. She said that there was another segment that she did not want to do where they were going to have her make out with another diva. And she refused. And then a week later, wouldn't you know, she lost her women's championship. Now, she said she lost the title to Mickie James as a result of that. The segment that she refused was making out with Tori Wilson. It was going to be a dance contest with Billy and Chuck, and it would be Trish and Tori. Trish and Tori would kiss and make out. They ended up having Stacey Keibler fill in for her instead. And she did not lose her title to Mickie at WrestleMania because of that. She lost the title to Jazz. And I think she was off TV after that for like a month. So I guess that was her punishment. That was her punishment for refusing to make out with her coworker the way Vince McMahon wanted her to. They covered Sable's $110 million sexual harassment lawsuit against the company. Not only did she end up coming back to the company, she did a similar storyline to Trish, where she was swapping spit on the air with Vince. And when Simmons asked him about the lawsuit, he acted like he couldn't remember anything about it. Like, what are you talking about? She came back to work, so who cares? Oh, you can bet if somebody filed a $100 million lawsuit against him, he remembers, but Sable is also shacked up with his sexting buddy, Brock. So he's not going to say anything negative about Sable. So then the company goes public, and he talked about how it allowed them to do other things like open a casino, which never opened, and a restaurant, which failed, and even a football league, which also failed. And that is to say nothing of the Bodybuilding Federation, which also failed. I'm sensing a pattern here. The Vince and Shane stuff was interesting. Back then, I just assumed that Shane, as everybody did, that Shane was going to one day, he was going to be the heir apparent, right? Or Shane and Stephanie, they were going to be the heir apparents running the company when Vince was gone. And Shane thought the same thing. So when Shane left the company, it was a huge shock. And here in the documentary, Vince flat out says the reason that Shane left is because he wanted my spot. He wanted to take over and he wanted Vince to step aside. And there have been stories that, you know, Shane may have made a power play and it blew up in his face. You know, it got back to Vince somehow. Somebody, filled him in on what was going on. Whatever happened, Shane was never going to win that battle. He was fighting a losing battle. Had he played the long game and kept his mouth shut and never left, right, when everything eventually happened with Vince years and years later, maybe Shane would have had his moment. But it always felt like it was Triple H's spot to lose. You know, Triple H, there were stories about him sitting in on production meetings as far back as 1997. He was the deciding voice on the Montreal Screwjob phone call. When they had the phone call the Wednesday before Montreal, it was Vince and Shawn and Triple H. He was the one on the phone call when Shawn was crying and he was folding like, okay, whatever, I'll do whatever you want me to do. It was Triple H who said, fuck that guy. If he's not willing to do business, we'll do business for him. And that was 97. He was still the blue blood. He was a nobody on TV. Oh, I'm sorry. He was King of the Ring. He wasn't a nobody, but he wasn't what he is now. I sometimes think that Vince looked at Triple H like more of a son than he did Shane. So who knows, with the power structure in this company, who knows what would have happened had Shane never left. It would have been very interesting. But Paul Heyman told this wild story about a fight that Vince and Shane had once over creative. Shane had an idea. Vince was adamantly against it. I would have loved to have known what this idea was. And they were eating, and so Vince picks up a knife, and he hands it to Shane, and then he points at his chest, and he says, right here, you're going to have to stab me in the heart. Because that's the only way you're ever going to be able to make that decision. And if you don't stick me with it, then I know you're not man enough to do it. So either do that or you can buy me out. And if I don't get out of your way, then be prepared to get rid of me like I would have had to get rid of my father. A totally rational response to a simple creative disagreement. And then they closed with an episode called The Finish, which, among other things, tackled the Benoit murder-suicide and the Janelle Grant lawsuit. So, a fun watch for the entire family. He talked about having two different brains, like computers in his head, where one is talking to the producer right now as they're doing this interview, and then the other brain is thinking of something totally different. And then Simmons goes, what about the third brain? And he goes, well, that brain is thinking about a lot of fun and something involving sex. This is right before the Grant lawsuit dropped, so the timing of him saying this is quite poetic. The Mr. McMahon death storyline is dropped when Chris Benoit kills his wife and son, and then himself, which gets into a conversation here about roid rage and brain damage and what was the cause of it. And they interviewed Chris Nowinski, right, the one-time WWE star who was forced into an early retirement due to concussions, and since then he has become a pretty central figure in concussion research and CTE. He was sure that Benoit had CTE, and he got permission from his father to study his brain, which he said was the worst brain that they had ever studied. Steve Austin then chimes in, and yet again I was left shaking my head at something dumb that somebody said. This happened a lot throughout these six episodes. But like the Brett comment about Owen being murdered, I was just gobsmacked when Austin said that, you know, I got dropped on my head one time. That was by Owen Hart. And I got a concussion, and that was the only concussion, or one of the only concussions, that I've ever had in my entire career. And he says that his take is that if you're getting a bunch of concussions, you're doing something wrong. And I'm not a CTE guy. I just don't believe in it. Well, thank you, Dr. Austin, for your analysis. Nowinski said he saw the slides. Benoit clearly had CTE. Just don't tell Stone Cold. That's almost as stupid as Vince saying that he doesn't believe Undertaker got concussed in his match with Brock Lesnar. But he was so traumatized by being told the streak was ending, that's the reason why he doesn't remember the match. I'm starting to think that every one of these fucking people has CTE. Then they got into the guest host era of Raw. They showed the Muppets. They started talking about the women's revolution. And again, I'm sitting here thinking, what are we doing here? Like, does this really need to be in here? We're veering off topic here. Vince gets asked if he's ever going to retire. And he says no. And he says, I've never understood why people stop growing. Once you stop growing, you die. So go die. Funny you should say that, because they skipped to 2022. And the first Wall Street Journal story about the hush money payments to former employees that he slept with. So defiant as ever, Vince goes on SmackDown that week, which will end up being his last ever appearance on WWE television, because I promise you, you will never see him back on WWE television live ever again, certainly not while there is a breath in his body. But he goes out there on SmackDown and people cheered and they bowed. One of the Wall Street Journal reporters interviewed in the documentary did bring up the tanning salon incident, which I was curious if they would, from 2006. I've talked about this before, where a woman who worked at a tanning salon in Boca Raton, where he has a house, she ran out of the tanning salon, all freaked out, ran into a Papa John's in the same strip mall in tears, asking for help because a man just tried to rape her. And no charges were ever brought against him, even though the police found probable cause to believe that he did what she accused him of doing. But the reason charges were never brought is because prosecutors didn't think they had enough evidence. And there were no cameras. Boy, it just must be bad luck that this man has been accused of rape or attempted rape no less than three times in his life. That's a lot of bad luck. 2 weeks later, After that incident, they aired a segment on TV where Mickey James made up a story about a man sexually assaulting her. Makes you wonder how many other times he incorporated his real-life experiences into storylines on TV. What the fuck was this guy doing 2 weeks before they shot that Katie Vick skit? Then the next Wall Street Journal story dropped a few weeks later. Even more women, even more money paid out, including $7.5 million to one former wrestler. I can only imagine what happened there, that he paid out $7 million to one woman. And that was enough that he posted a random tweet on a Friday afternoon. I'll never forget it. I thought he was hacked. I didn't even think it was real. Just a random tweet. 77 years old, time to retire. Right? The one thing that he mocked people for doing here in these interviews that he did for this documentary where, you know, oh, I'll never retire. And I don't know why people do that. And, you know, go die. I guess Vince was ready to die. Or not. Because he spent the next 6 months plotting his return to the company, which he ultimately did. And as soon as he did, Stephanie, who had stepped in as co-CEO when he left, immediately dipped out. She wanted nothing to do with working with her father anymore. So then they sell to Endeavor. Vince is kept on as executive chairman of the newly formed TKO, which oversees WWE and UFC, or has it under the same umbrella. And there he is sitting alongside Ari Emanuel with his shitty evil mustache on CNBC. One thing I will say that this documentary failed to do was show Ari Emanuel in that same interview fawning over Vince, his good buddy, and flat out admitting that doing the deal was contingent on Vince still being a part of the company. He flat out said without Vince, he wouldn't have done that deal. And this is even after the initial allegations came out, but before the Janelle Grant stuff. Why was he so adamant that Vince stay on? I mean, you had Endeavor for like months issuing financial statements to the SEC where they would have to acknowledge in the fine print that Vince McMahon being on board was a liability. It could hurt their company. And yet they kept him on. That needed to be mentioned, and it wasn't. Now, I know Netflix is in bed with WWE right now. Raw is moving to Netflix in January. Did that have anything to do with it? Who knows? So then the Netflix deal is announced on January 23rd of this year. The same day that Bruce Pritchard sits down yet again with the producers here and is asked, what did you think of the early cut that you saw of the documentary? And he says it sucks and it makes Vince look bad. On and on and on. 2 days later, the Janelle Grant sex trafficking lawsuit is filed. And all hell breaks loose. And so ends the era of McMahon. The very next day, sponsors begin to pull out. Ari Emanuel, Mark Shapiro probably, right? The Endeavor Brain Trust. They no doubt, I'm sure, talked to Vince, met with Vince, put pressure on Vince to do the right thing, and Vince McMahon resigns from TKO. He is now a pariah in his own company. A legacy forever tarnished. And he has nobody to blame for that but himself. Bruce Pritchard can defend the man until he turns blue in the face. How he even gets oxygen to the brain with his lips pasted to the man's ass, I'll never know. I guess he breathes through his nose. But he can defend the man until he turns blue in the face and make every excuse for him that he wants. You can call it a hit job. You can call it a gotcha piece. It's called karma. And it bit him on the ass. Because he thought that he was Teflon. He thought that he was untouchable. With the Grant stuff alone, the cavalier way that he was sharing these text messages with people, the paper trail of messages, you would think that he would be smarter about that, but he didn't care. Because he's the all-powerful Vince McMahon. Nothing keeps him down, not even the federal government. Not yet, anyway. The government may yet get its revenge, we'll see. But the federal government, Ted Turner, Phil Mushnick, the evil mainstream media when Linda ran for Senate. Remember that? They started the Stand Up for WWE campaign. None of them could take him down. He was finally done in by his own hubris. Vince McMahon is the greatest promoter in wrestling history. Mr. McMahon is the greatest heel. I believe both of those things to be true. He has been a part of some of the most memorable moments on television. I will always look back fondly on those moments. And I very likely am not sitting here right now doing this podcast had I not grown up watching his product on TV every single week. From the time that I was 5 years old, he was part of the soundtrack of my childhood, listening to Vince McMahon on commentary. But that doesn't change the fact that Vince McMahon, for whatever good traits he may have, is an absolutely deplorable human being. Actions have consequences. And it may have taken 78 years, but his actions finally caught up to him. And look what happened. The company didn't fall apart without him. The product actually got better. They're making more money now than they ever have. They're setting new records every other month. Because there was always this question of what's going to happen when Vince isn't there anymore? What's going to happen if Vince drops dead? We no longer have to wonder. The company is in very capable hands. Vince is the one who built it into what it is today and deserves the credit for that. But this is something that should have happened a long time ago. As far as the documentary goes, I enjoyed it for what it was, which was more or less a trip down memory lane, the good and the bad. But you're not going to learn much in the way of new information here, because wrestling fans are not the main audience for this. There were definitely some topics that could have been trimmed out. There were others that could have been expanded upon, and it would have helped to have a main subject who was more willing to be open and honest about their life. But when that person makes it very clear that they're not willing to be either of those things, you're not going to get a very compelling product.
Hey, it's Chris Van Vliet, and after this episode's done, go check out my podcast, Insight with Chris Van Vliet. Any of the interview clips that you might have seen on social media or on YouTube are all available in audio form. This week on the show, Ethan Page is talking about what led to his decision to leave AEW and then win the NXT Championship just 40 days after he debuted. We've also got some recent episodes with Dave Bautista, Otis, Damian Priest, Ken Shamrock, Cody Rhodes, Jesse Ventura, and a bunch of others. Listen to Insight with Chris Van Vliet on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or, of course, wherever you're listening to this right now.
Some other news and notes. We've been wondering where WWE would be hosting SummerSlam next year, since we already know they're running two nights in Minneapolis in 2026. But that won't be the first ever two-night SummerSlam. That will be next year, because SummerSlam is coming to MetLife Stadium in New Jersey on Saturday, August 2nd and Sunday, August 3rd. MetLife has hosted two WrestleManias before, that being 29 and 35, but never a SummerSlam. And they had Cardi B and Bianca Belair appear in a video together to announce the date and the location. I thought Gillette Stadium in New England with John Cena challenging for title number 17 would have been a great attraction. They did go with the Northeast, just not the Northeast Stadium I was thinking of. The first thing that jumped out to me in the logo was the mention of New Jersey and not New York. That's probably a Vince-ism that they have done away with, because before it was New York, New Jersey. Had to have New York in there. I guess Jersey isn't big enough to be on its own. Even when Vince ran the XFL the first time, it was the New York, New Jersey Hitmen. But now it's just New Jersey. But the tri-state area is also the biggest media market in the country. So that is a plus for them running there. And I've said this before, the Royal Rumble is going to go 2 days as well. It may not be in 2025, but the Royal Rumble will end up being a two-night event. WrestleMania will continue to be a two-night event. SummerSlam going forward will be two nights. At the very least, the major shows. And that would include a show like Money in the Bank or Elimination Chamber. We will, I believe, get to a point where all of those shows do end up being two nights. But not a doubt in my mind, the next one that goes two nights after this in the next couple of years is going to be the Royal Rumble. And you'll have a men's rumble on one night and a women's rumble on the other night. Raw last Monday averaged 1.339 million viewers on USA, down 11% from the previous week. That is the second lowest rating the show has ever done for a live episode in its history on the USA Network. And the key demo was also down, but it was still second only to Monday Night Football. Compared to Raw's overall audience a year ago, the show was down almost 9%. Now, they get crushed by Monday Night Football every year. right? Every September, this is what happens. But it's like I've always said, the lows keep getting lower. But they're not going to have to worry about that anymore once they go to Netflix, because these Raw ratings, like Vince McMahon, will become extinct. So these Raw ratings reports, which I don't really do very often anymore, but periodically I will when they set a record, good or bad. This is not a good record to set. But you're not going to have to hear about this very often going forward, because again, once they go to Netflix, these Nielsen numbers are going to go bye-bye. You'll get them for SmackDown, but you're not going to get them for Raw anymore. Per PW Insider, one of the major discussions backstage at Raw this week circled around what will be closing the Bad Blood pay-per-view. Mike Johnson says that we are told the initial plan as of months ago was to build the pay-per-view around the idea of the anniversary of the first ever Hell in a Cell in 1997, since the event this year lands on the exact same date. That would have meant CM Punk against Drew McIntyre should have closed the show. There has been a push in certain circles of the company that Cody Rhodes and Roman Reigns, teaming for the first time ever and in a city that has significant historical significance to each, that being Atlanta, should headline the show against the Bloodline. We are told the final decision has not yet been made. All I'm going to say is this. Like, to me, I don't care either way, but you've got CM Punk and Drew McIntyre going on television now, both men promising to make the other bleed inside the cell. I still think you close with that, unless they have some kind of big angle plan for the other match. If there is some sort of major angle or introduction of a new talent or a heel turn or something, then totally understandable. You would want to go off the air with that as your big cliffhanger. But otherwise, I still feel the same way that I felt weeks ago, which is that Punk and McIntyre should be closing the show. And on that note, because Bad Blood is next Saturday, I'm going to run through the card right now and give you my predictions, because I think the card is pretty much set. They have got their five matches here. Could always add a sixth one this week. I'm not sure what that would be, but let's run through this here. We have Nia Jax and Bayley for the WWE Women's Championship. It is now set. Bayley beat Naomi on SmackDown Friday night to become the number one contender and get her rematch. You know, there's going to be a match probably on SmackDown this coming Friday between Naomi and Tiffany Stratton, because they had a little backstage segment. I've been going back and forth between whether or not Tiffany cashes in here, and if she does, she's going to win the title, but I think what I see is a Nia Jax win. I mean, Bayley is not going to win the title, but I see a Nia Jax win where Tiffany comes out, maybe tries to get involved, and Naomi comes out to try to counteract her. But I think Naomi may end up inadvertently costing Bayley the match, because there's been some real undertones between them lately that make me think that Naomi may be going heel soon. And if that's the case, I don't think it's an outright heel turn, but I do think that her coming out thinking that she's helping, and in the end she actually hurts Bayley unintentionally and leads to her loss, that seems more realistic to me. So I'm going to go with that as the setup for a Nia Jax win, and they hold off a little longer on Tiffany cashing in, hopefully not that much longer. The other women's championship match has Liv Morgan defending against Rhea Ripley. The stipulation, Dirty Dom is suspended above the ring in a shark cage. Brother is having flashbacks to being behind bars. This almost seems too obvious to me. It just makes me want to pick Liv Morgan. I'm actually going to do that. I'm going to go with Liv Morgan to retain, because I think that they want you to think that Dominic has been neutralized. And so now Liv Morgan is all by herself. She's got nobody to help her. And I had talked about a potential idea heading into SummerSlam, and it didn't pan out this way, but I still think that there's a good chance of this. And there was a report not that many weeks ago that Raquel Rodriguez is being discussed internally as far as a potential return and what they could do with her. The idea that with Dominic up in the cage, Rhea's got this woman dead to rights, and you have Raquel come back, because Raquel is somebody who has history with both Liv and with Rhea. Her and Rhea used to be thick as thieves. They used to be best friends in NXT, right? Turned enemies. with Liv, Raquel and Liv were former tag team champions. So there's history there. The idea that Raquel comes back in this spot helps Liv retain the title and now serves to Liv as what Camille is right now to Mercedes, for example, in AEW. I could see that working. And what it also does is it gives Rhea a challenger in the meantime to have to go through before she gets Liv back again. And the next time you run back Liv and Rhea, and you don't have to wait, you know, until next year to do it. I mean, you could do it at Crown Jewel. You could do it at Saturday Night's Main Event. But I think there's more juice left to this thing, even if it's only a couple more months. So why not? I mean, what's the harm? And I posed this question on, I think, my Raw review on Monday night. What the hell are they going to do with Rhea Ripley if they just put the title on her and they kill this feud dead? If you keep the title on Liv, you kind of have the same problem because other than Rhea, there's no obvious, you know, feud for her right now. But if they keep the title on her, then they're building to one more match with Rhea. That's the whole point. You're adding a new dimension to it with Raquel, which makes it a little bit different. And then ultimately Rhea beats her and gets the belt. So I don't really see any good challenger for Rhea if they put the title on her now. I kind of fear like it would be this dead zone until we get into WrestleMania season. So I'm going to go with Liv Morgan. I like the Raquel idea. And frankly, even if Raquel is not going to show up and be a part of this, I just feel like, you know, Dom's going to slip something down to her. There's going to be something going on here. It's going to lead to another Liv win. And then their third meeting is where Rhea, you know, fair and square, will ultimately get the championship. And I don't see the harm in that. You know, you drag it out a little bit longer. It's the biggest women's feud they have going right now. So why not? Damian Priest against Finn Balor. This is the first meeting between these two since Balor turned on Priest. A lot of history here. Going back a couple of years, all that time in the Judgment Day. It's only the first meeting. I think Finn Balor should win this match. I think he will win this match. So I'm going with him. And then we have really the two main events. We'll talk Hell in a Cell, I guess. Again, I'm hoping this closes the show, but whether it opens or it closes, CM Punk and Drew McIntyre, it will be the close of their feud. McIntyre won the first one at SummerSlam. Punk came back and won the strap match at Bash in Berlin. So this is the rubber match here. This should close out this feud once and for all. They're inside the cell. It's a blood feud in that they have both promised blood in this match. So that makes things a little more interesting. And look, I'm not ruling out a Drew McIntyre win. It's possible he could go over here at the end. It would surprise me, though. I still feel like CM Punk, ultimately, the plan all along was probably for him to go over and get the win in this feud. If that happens, Drew McIntyre, I don't know where he goes from here on Raw because I don't know that you can keep him and Punk in the same building every week. It's almost like one of those feuds where, you know, this roster isn't big enough for the both of us. And I talked about this on Friday in my SmackDown review. AJ Styles is coming back to SmackDown on Friday night. What is he going to do? Is he going to be a heel? Is he going to be a babyface? We don't know yet. They could certainly use some top heels on SmackDown. The problem is he's already worked a program with Cody Rhodes and he's already worked with LA Knight. And they're the two top babyface champions on SmackDown. He doesn't seem like the best fit right now to be a heel at the top of the SmackDown roster. In McIntyre and AJ, I see two big names that they could easily flip in a trade between the two GMs where SmackDown gets McIntyre and Styles goes to Raw. You know, maybe as a babyface, and maybe you could even build to a title match with AJ and Gunther. I think that would be fun. I think McIntyre loses here and Punk gets the win. And then Cody Rhodes and Roman Reigns. I guess kind of like their modern day mega powers, the two biggest stars, the two biggest babyfaces in the entire company. Team up for the first time to take on Solo Sikoa and Jacob Fatu. What a spot for Jacob Fatu to be in. It's hard for me to imagine, barring some major angle, major turn, involving Kevin Owens or Randy Orton or something like that. It's hard for me to imagine Cody Rhodes and Roman Reigns, the two biggest stars in the company, going in there and losing. We already saw Cody in a tag team match at Money in the Bank, right? It was a six-man. Losing to Solo Sikoa. So now here we are all these months later. We're going into bad blood. Cody and Roman on the same side. Roman's first match since losing at WrestleMania. I don't see Roman Reigns losing in his first match back, and I don't see Cody Rhodes as the WWE champion taking the loss either. At least when Cody Rhodes got pinned by Solo Sikoa at Money in the Bank, it made sense because Solo was getting the title match at SummerSlam. I don't want to see Solo Sikoa get another title match. He's already had two. Do you really think they're going to have Jacob Fatu pin Cody Rhodes? Because if he does, then Jacob should be next in line for a title match. And that just feels like it's too soon to go there. Cody and Roman is the predictable play, but I think it's probably the correct one. I think that's what we're going to get. Again, whether or not they close the show or not, I think may just depend on whether or not there's a big angle for them to shoot. But I'm going with Cody Rhodes and Roman Reigns for the win. And then after that, we'll get a better sense of what the hell War Games is going to look like. You know, are they going to try to go to Bloodline against Bloodline? I mean, right now there's only one Bloodline. They've got a lot of work to do if they want to squeeze that in there. Or do they go with a match like Roman, Cody, Randy, and KO against the Bloodline? To me, at this moment, that's the match that makes more sense. But I'm also recording this here on September 29th, and War Games is 2 months away. A lot can happen in 2 months. We shall see. But the card looks good, and I'm looking forward to it. That's going to be next Saturday. And just keep in mind, early start time, because they're trying to wrap up before the UFC pay-per-view that night. So that's why it is a 6 p.m. Eastern start time, a little bit different than usual. And as soon as the show is over, you can catch the live review on YouTube, as always. Jey Uso is the new Intercontinental Champion. For the very first time in his career, he is a singles champion. He defeated Bron Breakker on Raw in the main event on Monday night. I thought the match was good, but I thought the finish was great. You know, Jey Uso wins the title. Everybody is going crazy. He goes off into the crowd. He's celebrating with the fans. The only drawback was that they were rushing off the air. So they didn't have very long to show him running into the crowd and pyro going off. So they did put a video up on their YouTube channel after the fact. But because they have that hard stop at 11 o'clock, it was like he won the title, ran off into the crowd, and they just did not give that moment time to really linger and really breathe and really play it up, you know, in a way that would make it feel like a big deal. And that's just, again, not something that really is in their control. Unless they did better management of their time on the show, they could have left more time for it. So it was a great moment. It does not hurt Bron Breakker at all, just to kind of bat down anybody who still feels that way, that, you know, it's going to damage him in some way, it's going to diminish him, it's going to bury him. I shudder when I hear that word, especially in this case. If you watch the match on Monday, Bron took the majority of it, and it took three spears and two Samoan splashes to do this man in. You would think that he took a super kick and a splash, and that was it. Jey Uso had to throw everything in his arsenal multiple times at this man, like the monster that wouldn't die, just to put him down. I'm not worried about Bron Breakker. Of all the people I may or may not be worried about in WWE or in AEW, as far as their push and what happens if they lose or they need to be pushed more, Bron Breakker, I'm not worried about him at all. Bron Breakker is going to be a multi-time world champion, a multi-time WrestleMania main eventer. He may well win back the Intercontinental title in short order. We'll see. But Jey Uso, you know, in many ways, Jey Uso had to win. It was now or never, because he has lost so many big matches this year. He's made so many promises about winning a singles title, and he failed. Right? He failed against Damian Priest, failed at the King of the Ring, failed at Money in the Bank. Fail. At some point, you know, you got to pull the trigger on the guy and either do it or you move on. And they went and they finally pulled the trigger on it. And now he's the champion, and we'll see how long it lasts. But I mean, Jey Uso is one of the most popular stars on the entire brand, Raw or SmackDown. It's kind of crazy it took this long, frankly, for them to put a title on him. So maybe they'll give him some time with it. Maybe it'll factor into an eventual Bloodline story in some way. Right now, they're completely disconnected. There's been no hints of anything as far as him being brought back into the Bloodline story. Where Jimmy ends up when he ultimately shows his face again on TV, you would think SmackDown. But, you know, who knows? Depending on what's going on with Jey in a month, Maybe he pops up on Raw first, tries to bring Jay back with him to SmackDown, right? This can go any number of ways. But Jay right now is doing his own thing. And like I said, Bron Breakker's going to be just fine. And per WrestleVotes Radio, they had a little nugget here. The Viking Raiders are both ready to return to the main roster, and they will likely be returning under the War Raiders name. There was a very brief video on Raw Monday night. It did not identify any wrestler. It had a symbol. Some people thought that it meant Rey Fénix and Penta. Boy, were those people wrong. A lot of people, though, pointed out that it was a symbol very similar, if not identical, to the symbol on the shield that the Viking Raiders used to bring out to the ring with them. So the belief was that, okay, it's a vignette hyping their return. And then WrestleVotes Radio dropped that little nugget there. They were the War Raiders in NXT. I mean, they were War Machine before they even came to WWE, but they were the War Raiders in NXT. Their name never should have been changed in the first place. They've been the Viking Raiders now for so long, it almost doesn't even matter, to be honest with you. Just objectively, War Raiders is a better name. So I hope this is true, and I'd like to see them go back to the name, but it's not like I was sitting here clamoring going, oh, I really wish they would make the Viking Raiders the War Raiders again. Like, I don't give a shit. You know, like, it doesn't matter. And Ivar was getting a nice singles push there for a while because Eric's been hurt for a long time. And then Ivar got hurt again. So I guess Ivar's singles push is over. It's too bad because, you know, this Monster Madness stuff that they've been doing with Bronson Reed and Braun Strowman, boy, he would fit in there like a glove. Imagine throwing Ivar in there. But evidently the Raiders are on their way back, and that's a good thing because it's another team to add to a tag team division that could really use them right now. And just some AEW notes before I get out of here, because we had Grand Slam on Wednesday, and we did have Bryan Danielson one-on-one with Nigel McGuinness for the first time in 15 years. Of course, the match was not billed as happening for sure. It was based on whether or not Bryan would be medically cleared. Would we or would we not get the match at Arthur Ashe Stadium, where they did end up with about 8,000 people in the venue. And there was no bait and switch. We just got a really good 20-minute professional wrestling match. But also, there was no fanfare. You know, they just kind of opened the show with it. And this is supposed to be a bigger episode of Dynamite than the standard episode. And they just opened the show. There was no video. They just sent them out there. Obviously, we didn't get a meeting between the two on TV in the lead-up to this. There was no face-to-face promo or contract signing or anything like that. It was Nigel McGuinness having to go out there and just sell the match all by himself. And that was pretty lame and very disappointing. And I don't know that we're ever going to see Bryan and Nigel again, because it wasn't like there was some big angle they shot. This really felt like, you know what? This is a match that these guys, Nigel in particular, really wanted. Bryan's full-time run is winding down. We may not have another chance to do this. And so let's just kind of do it and get it out of the way. And that's what they did. So again, the match was fine, but I just look back at this and go, man, this could have been so much more fun than it was. But the match itself was very good. It's a very good match. Bryan gets the win, no surprise there. He's the champion. He should win. We also had Darby Allin putting his championship opportunity on the line against Jon Moxley. And wouldn't you know, Darby the Dweeb loses his spot that he did not even have to put up in the first place, but he did anyway. A spot that he was supposed to cash in on against Bryan on this show. And Bryan did end up wrestling, but Darby put his shot on the line and lost it to Moxley. And so now, official for Wrestle Dream, it's going to be Bryan Danielson defending the title against Jon Moxley. And I'm not doing predictions yet for Wrestle Dream, but if I had a look at this and you said, who do I think is going to go over and win the championship or retain? It's not going to be Bryan Danielson, it's going to be Jon Moxley, because we still have to see where this whole story with the BCC is going to go. I did see the Young Bucks post a photo on social media with Shane McMahon. They met up at an airport, a chance meeting at the airport. More Shane McMahon photos with AEW talent. This is not accidental. Clearly something is going on here. And it would make sense for him to be involved in this in some way. Where he gets plugged in, I have no idea. But if it's going to happen, Maybe it happens this week on the 5-year anniversary show. Maybe it happens at WrestleDream. We'll see. Right now, the only major thing announced for the 5-year anniversary show this week is Will Ospreay defending his international title against Ricochet. And I am not expecting a new international champion to be crowned. I actually laid out a whole potential scenario, an idea where Ospreay and Ricochet end up as allies, and they end up maybe even being partners on the same side, you know, against the Callis family. Who knows? Maybe they even get a tag team title run at some point before they eventually come back around to Ospreay and Ricochet in 2025. But that's me. Tony Khan, I mean, he loves blowing through this shit as quickly as possible, but that's just me. The other thing on Dynamite on Wednesday was we had the debut of MVP, who showed up by himself. So there was no Bobby Lashley, there was no Shelton Benjamin. Clearly Lashley, at least, is on his way in. I mean, there's not a doubt in my mind. But there was no mention of him or tease or anything. What it was MVP coming out to confront Prince Nana, who was there to give us a medical update on Shane Strickland, Swerve Strickland, who has been out since All Out. And we were told that physically he's not quite medically cleared yet, but he will be back soon. And then MVP came out. And basically, MVP was making a play for him, and he handed off a business card to Prince Nana, and it's like he was courting possible talent for him to manage here in AEW. So now the question is, what's Swerve going to do when he comes back? You know, is he going to break away from Prince Nana? Is he going to link up with MVP? Probably not. And could this be a sign of a Swerve-Lashley feud coming in AEW soon? Yeah, it's a tough one, because if it were me, I'm not sure I would really be moving Swerve away from the world title picture, but then again, I would rather then put the world title on Hangman, just because I think Hangman's doing great work right now, and you get that championship on him, have him be the one to beat Bryan Danielson, give him a little run with the title, and eventually Swerve works his way back up into contention, and we get that ultimate final battle between Swerve and Hangman. Sometime maybe early next year, and when it finally happens, it's for the championship, and then Swerve wins the belt back. I don't know if that's the direction they're planning on going, and now, again, it looks like Swerve's branching off into something completely different, which he should. I mean, I'm not saying that I would have him do anything with Hangman right now. I definitely think you want to separate them for a while, but if you're going to introduce somebody new to the roster like Lashley, that just doesn't seem to bode well for Swerve. You know, when he comes back, as far as, you know, coming out the winner of that. So we'll see where it goes, and we'll see if Lashley maybe will make an appearance on the anniversary show this week. But the other story here that I wanted to touch on involves the Lucha Bros, who we have not seen in quite a while on AEW television. And the belief is, the reason for that, is because they're leaving and because they are going to be on their way to WWE, whether that means NXT, whether that means directly to the main roster. Remains to be seen. As of right now, they're not going anywhere, because this is the update on Penta and Rey Fénix. The current situation is as follows. They have not signed with WWE. That's number one, because there were some Twitter accounts putting out rumors about them having already been signed, a multi-year deal. They're going straight to the main roster. They're making merch. And that's bullshit. They have not signed with WWE. They are still under contract to AEW. They would not be able to even talk to WWE, let alone sign a contract with WWE. The latest, and this comes from Fightful, is that Tony Khan has extended the Lucha Bros deals. And in particular, Rey Fénix is the name that's been thrown around. But my understanding from some of these reports is that Penta has also had time tacked on. Sean Ross Sapp says that Penta would have been up by now. He would have been a free man. So the fact that if he is still there, that means that they added time onto his contract. I would guess that means injury time. I know Rey Fénix has been really banged up and injured, and he missed quite a bit of time. So for him, that's probably a pretty significant period. It's been said that it could be up to a year more that Fénix has had tacked on and that he may be stuck in AEW. Fightful Select says there was no straight answer as to the motivation of extending the Lucha Bros AEW deals outside of the company wanting to get the contracted amount of time out of them that they were signed for per the terms of their contract. It is expected by talent that they will be asked to put talent over at the very least if they are planning on leaving. Because Tony Khan has tried to re-sign them, and they have said no. You know, they could have been signed to new deals by now. Clearly they want out. Clearly they're planning on going somewhere else, and we know where that is. And if that's the case, it sounds like Tony Khan may be more interested in using them to do job duty than anything else. And he also said that it's going to be a while before they are in WWE, if in fact that is where they want to go. So that's a definite change, because this was talked about many weeks ago, and from the sounds of it, Tony Khan was not going to do that. And we don't hear stories about that very often, if ever, from Tony Khan, that he's tacking on injury time. That's something we heard, you know, Vince McMahon used to do that all the time. He did it with Rey Mysterio because he was out with a number of injuries and he added months on to his contract. Usually you hear about that when it comes to WWE. This is new. This is new for Tony. So now it's either a question of I'm going to pay them to sit at home, or I'm going to make them the most expensive jobbers in pro wrestling. Or if Penta were to get out of his contract before Phoenix, I suppose he could always go work as a single in WWE, which would be fine because, I mean, that was my exposure to Penta the first time was in Lucha Underground, and I thought he was great by himself. You know, the Lucha Bros only became a thing really in AEW. I mean, they may have been doing that before Lucha Underground, but I'm just saying, as far as being on TV, Penta was doing fine on his own, you know, before the Lucha Bros thing came to TV. But right now, it looks like both of them are pretty much stuck where they're going to be now for a while in AEW. And those are the two options. You either pay them to sit at home and do nothing for the next however many months, or you make them the most expensive job guys in the entire company. Because I'm sure they're getting paid well. Now, this may not have been the first time that Tony Khan has done this, because I was thinking about this. You know, Jeff Hardy, I could have sworn that this happened to Jeff Hardy, where Jeff, I don't know how much time it was, but I could have sworn that Jeff had time added to his contract for all the time that he missed. Again, I could be wrong about that, so this may not have been the first time that Tony Khan has done something like this. But there's a lot of talk about Conan. Conan is not on good terms with Tony Khan and AEW, and there's a lot of angst there, and a lot of it has to do, I think, with, you know, Tony having a working relationship with CMLL. CMLL, of course, is at war with AAA. But Conan doesn't have a lot of very nice things to say about Tony Khan or AEW in recent times. But Conan also likes to talk. And Conan, of course, is very friendly with Penta and Rey Fénix and a lot of the Mexican talent, and has worked with them before and advocated for them. But he also goes on his podcast and social media, and he talks. And he talks probably when he shouldn't, because sometimes it can blow back on other people, and not in a good way. And I don't know if Conan is one of these people who was talking about WWE making Lucha Bros merch. Again, that may not have been him, but he's definitely made certain comments that would lead one to believe that they were going to end up in WWE. And if you remember, Penta, not that long ago, posted a message on his Twitter, because there were so many rumors going around that, you know, Penta is telling people that they're going to WWE and telling people in the locker room that he's leaving. And he went on social media and completely contradicted it. But he did that probably because he realized, oh, shit, you know, I don't want this to get around to Tony Khan, and then it, you know, jeopardizes our ability to actually leave. Or, you know, I don't want them to tack time on to my brother's contract or my contract. And ultimately, that's what Tony Khan did. So I'm reading all these different things, and it sounds to me like, first of all, Conan probably didn't do these guys any favors. That's number one. But number two, it does sound very petty. Tony Khan does have them under contract, so legally, you know, he can do that. I mean, he's within his rights to do that. I don't generally like stuff like this. I think it's bullshit. It does seem very petty. I could completely understand Tony Khan being upset if Penta was running his mouth, Conan, whatever. And it almost was just a foregone conclusion that these guys, they're already signed, you know, even if they're not. Like, they're already basically in WWE. They're already making plans. They're thinking about merch concepts. And then I put myself in Tony Khan's shoes, and yeah, you know what? I'd be pretty fucking pissed too, because we know how angry he's gotten in the past about WWE tampering and, you know, Talon going over there. Jade Cargill, you know, Jade, he went to her and said, what do you want? You know, I'll give you what you want. And she threw a number at him and he was willing to match it. And she left anyway. You know, I'm sure stuff like that really gets under his skin. And he believes that WWE is doing some underhanded stuff to him and his company. So when it comes to WWE, Tony is ultra sensitive. And in a way, you can kind of understand it. But I still feel like you're taking it out on two guys who don't deserve it. And if they don't want to be there anymore, and their contracts were supposed to be up, and they're planning on going somewhere else, yeah, you know what? Penta should not be running his mouth backstage if that's what he's doing. If he's going around telling people what his plans are, that was fucking stupid. That's number one. I feel like there's nobody blameless. Maybe Rey Fénix, but very few people who are blameless in this situation. Penta should not be running his mouth to anybody, publicly or privately, about what their plans are going to be. And Tony Khan extending their deals, if he's not planning on utilizing them in a meaningful way, is a fucking waste. It is a waste. Because you're going to sit them on the bench and they're going to get paid to do nothing. And it's the Miro thing I talked about last week. Miro clearly doesn't want to be there. You're not getting any value out of him. And if you're not going to push him or he's not going to show up to fucking work and he wants to leave, whether he's going to WWE or not, then you know what? Cut your losses and let him go and take that money and put it towards something else. And I feel the same way about Penta and Rey Fénix at this point. If Tony doesn't have any real plans for them, if he's going to put them on job duty or not use them at all and put them on the bench, which is what's happening with Ricky Starks right now and maybe others, to me, it's just a complete fucking waste. So it's an unfortunate situation. Again, Tony's within his rights to do it. I still think it's bullshit. And now we're just going to have to wait a little bit longer because inevitable, these two are going to go to WWE, I'm sure. But it may be a while, you know, before that happens. And, you know, that could be a year. It could be 6 months or a year of their career wasted. You know, Fénix has really been banged up. So, I mean, if he's going to be sitting at home, it'll give him plenty of time to heal up. But in the meantime, they can still work independent dates. It's not like they can't work and get their name out there, even if Tony isn't doing anything with them. That's one of the big differences between WWE and AEW. Yeah, these guys can still go out there and book their own shots and get their name out there, but it's not going to be the same, you know, if they're not on TV. So it sucks. If you're a fan of the Lucha Bros, which I am, it's just a shitty situation all around and very petty on Tony's part. But I can understand him being upset and maybe feeling disrespected if people are chattering behind his back and he feels like these guys are putting the cart before the horse. And they have already got 1 foot out the door, and he feels like, wait a minute, I haven't gotten the return on investment that I put in here that I was expecting. So I understand the mindset, but I kind of wish they would just sit down, if they haven't already, just get in a room together, sit down, and try to work this out. And he could ask them flat out, like, what's going on here? What do you guys want? How can we still do business together? And if they're not in a position where they really want to be doing business there anymore, maybe they could talk it out and come to some kind of an understanding. Maybe they could still get out of their contract sooner, right? It's not impossible to think maybe he'll change his mind. But if not, I just think it's very petty and it's just a very shitty situation if you're a fan of the Lucha Bros. And I'm generally just not a fan of when either company does this. It doesn't matter what the initials are to me. Now, there are certain situations where maybe I would feel differently. You know, maybe if you had somebody who was severely injured, they had spinal fusion surgery and they were under contract and getting paid, and they were literally on the shelf for like 13 months, you know, or something like that. You know what? Then I can understand the promoter saying, I'm going to tack some time on. Maybe not 13 months, but I'm going to tack on some time to try to get back something, you know, that I paid for here. But in a case like this, it's just one of those situations where try to work something out. And if these guys don't want to be there, and they have put in a lot of blood, sweat, and tears already into this company, it's not as if they've been on the shelf and injured for their entire run. They are AEW originals who have been there since day one. They have been two of the most popular stars in the entire company, former tag team champions. They've been part of some of the greatest matches in the history of this company. They have put in the work, and it would suck to see their run come to an end in this way. So I'm hoping that they could come to some kind of an agreement and an understanding, and they can get all this worked out. And if they want to leave, then let them leave and move on. Shake hands and let them go their separate ways. In an interview on the Queen's Flip YouTube channel, Swerve Strickland said that with SmackDown leaving Fox recently, AEW would not only work with Warner Brothers Discovery, but also Fox. He said, "We're about to move. We're about to get on Fox. SmackDown is leaving Fox, and then we're taking Fox. TNT, TBS, and Fox. We got all three of them things. Tony Khan lets me do whatever the fuck I want. He owns the Jacksonville Jaguars." Evidently, he does let him do whatever he wants, because that's the first time that an AEW personality has gone on record to leak anything about this potential Fox deal that we've been hearing about. So nothing announced official yet still. We're waiting on the TV stuff. And if there is more than one deal, but according to Swerve, at least, he believes that AEW is heading to Fox. And when he says heading to Fox, that doesn't necessarily mean the main network. It could mean FS1. That was the report as of last week. But according to him, AEW is heading to Fox. We'll have to wait and see. William Regal was not happy this week. He is rejecting claims about his time in AEW. He went on X, went on Twitter to praise NXT because their show is moving from the USA Network to the CW as of this week. And somebody in the comments section thanked him for his work in NXT, but also, quote, snaking out the competition, clearly referring to AEW. Regal responded back, rejecting those claims. Obviously, it touched a nerve, and he posted a lengthy diatribe here, I guess you would say. This is what he said. FYI, although it serves some people's agenda, and having a massive amount of people who work in AEW that can only back me up, I went to AEW to help because Bryan Danielson asked me to. Please find me one person who can say otherwise. I arrived at 10 a.m. until 6:15 p.m. to train anyone who wanted to come, apart from going to the restroom and refilling my water container. I never attended a single production meeting, as I knew if I were to stay there, I needed people to realize that I was only there to help. Nor did I ask a single question about anybody that works there's contract status. I helped at the ring with what any of the talent needed. I showered and got into a suit by 6:30 and then watched the monitor with everyone else. I'm giving you the right to ask anybody who works backstage or talent the right to ask them if I did anything but help with no agenda. Feel free. I also did not call Tony when his mom was ill. He called me. And as soon as he told me where he was, I ended the phone call and we spoke 2 weeks later. FYI, my deal was up in December of 28. I don't know if that meant 2028 or if it was up on December 28th. Anyway, he says that's when I left. So that can't mean 2028. These are all facts I can prove. Anyone trying to twist this has the right to check this out. I am friendly with 60% plus of the talent and backstage crew. Feel free to do some real research. Well, there you go. William Regal setting the record straight on his time in AEW. Deadline.com reported exclusively this week that Maxwell Jacob Friedman, MJF, is the latest to join the cast of Netflix's Happy Gilmore 2, starring Adam Sandler. Details as to his role is under wraps, as is the sequel's plot. Others on board include Julie Bowen and Chris McDonald, who reprise their respective roles as Virginia Vennett and Shooter McGavin, the love interest and pro golfer, respectively. Of Adam Sandler's, or pro golfer antagonist of Adam Sandler's title character. Recently, Sandler has also teased that Travis Kelce is on board for a cameo, with production now underway, and Bad Bunny has joined the cast. So then Mike Johnson of PW Insider had some more information here. He said Deadline described the role as under wraps, but I can exclusively confirm that MJF is playing the role of Gordy, one of Happy Gilmore's sons in the film. So he will be playing Adam Sandler's son. We are told that the Gilmore sons... Oh man, it's too bad that he didn't have daughters. It could have been the Gilmore girls. I'll show myself out. We are told that the Gilmore sons are all tough, crazy bastards with New England accents who have inherited their father's love of hockey. They all live out on their own and work blue-collar jobs. We are told that the script for the film calls for the sons to be seen at different ages across the film, and the film is shooting in New Jersey through November. That is where MJF has been, by the way. Supposedly, he was filming a movie role. That's why they shot the angle with Daniel Garcia sending him out on a stretcher. And now we know the movie that he's filming. That's pretty cool. See, I, like a lot of people, when I first heard this, I just assumed that MJF was going to be playing the son of Shooter McGavin. That would seem to make more sense to me, because I could totally see him as being Shooter's son. So him being Happy Gilmore's son, I guess that works too. And finally here, I know that this is going to be heartbreaking and devastating to all of you, so get the tissues ready. But Ric Flair announced that he and Wendy Barlow have decided to go their separate ways. The pair met in 1993 while working together in WCW. Barlow portrayed the character of a French maid named Fifi in the Flair for the Gold segments that the company was producing at the time. They announced their engagement in 2016 and held a wedding ceremony in 2018. Flair revealed on Monday that after 13 years, they have decided to part ways respectfully. He said, "Wendy and I enjoyed 13 great years. As with every couple, we have experienced our ups and downs. I think it's important for everyone to know right now that we have decided to part ways respectfully. I will never, ever be able to thank her enough for standing by my side through my terrible health crisis in 2017. She never left my side, and for that I will always be grateful. We are both working on different projects at the current time, and it becomes difficult with my schedule and her schedule to make this work. I wish her the best of luck with her projects, and I know that she supports mine." Now, if all of this sounds familiar, this is not the first time that we've heard this. This is the second time in the last few years that Flair has announced that he and Wendy are splitting. The last time this happened was in 2022. I don't believe he and Wendy were actually married. I think they had a wedding ceremony, but like legally, I don't think they were actually married. So they're not getting a divorce per se. But how many is this now? Five? Four? Five? Six? 12? I have a feeling. Here's what I think is going on. I think that Ric Flair is trying to tie his world title record in terms of divorces. So I think he's got a ways to go until he hits 16, which is kind of that fake number that WWE uses, but we'll go with that one. So I think he's up to like 5 now. So he still has a ways to go, but I feel like that's what he's aiming for here. Well, I mean, you can't see me right now, but the tears are streaming down my face. This is terrible. But I wanted to share this with all of you because, I mean, this was just earth-shattering news that I wasn't expecting here. And while I do hate to end on a sour note, I have no other choice because that is all the news that I have for you. And we're going to get back to the mailbag next week because this McMahon stuff took up all my time. That and my prep for House of Glory, which is where you can hear me and see me tonight, 6 p.m. Eastern time on Triller TV Plus, or come on out to the NYC Arena in Jamaica, Queens. There's still some tickets available at hogwrestling.net. Joe Hendry is going to be there. And who will answer the open challenge of Mike Santana? Zilla Fatu will be there. A lot of good shit. So make sure you check out the show. I will be back with you next Sunday, which happens to be my birthday. So I will get to celebrate my birthday with all of you by recording episode 882. So that's going to be coming up next weekend. And of course, in between, we have Raw, the post show on Monday night. Tuesday night, I will be live with a rare NXT live stream talking about the first CW show. No Dynamite review on Wednesday. I will not be here, but then back on Friday night for the SmackDown post show, then Bad Blood on Saturday. And it all culminates with the flagship, 882 next Sunday. Follow me on social media, on Twitter at Solomonster. Subscribe on YouTube. I will be back with you. Until then, be well, stay safe, and I will see you back here next weekend for more Sound Off. As always, until then, take care, guys.
The Solo Monster sounds off.
Esru, any advice on what to say to a coworker confuse Liv Morgan with Alexa Bliss? As far as what to say to your coworker, I would just correct your coworker. They're both blonde. It's not unreasonable to think that somebody who isn't a hardcore diehard fan would get them confused. I wouldn't go too hard on them. People confuse blondes all the time. Take it from me. I get messages every day. Every single white guy in an old wrestling photo. Hey, that looks like Solomonster. Bryan Danielson, a young Bryan Danielson. That kind of looks like Solomonster. Orange Cassidy. That kind of looks like Solomonster. Jack Swagger. That kind of looks like Solomonster. There was some Swedish fucking soccer player that somebody tweeted me once. That looks like Solomonster.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Since 2007.
Bringing you the good,
the bad,
and the ugly. Check out the weekly live streams, bonus content for subscribers, and follow The Solomonster on Facebook, Instagram, and X. The Solomonster.
That kind of looks like Solomonster.